The industry has no technology to clean up meaningful amounts of oil spilled in any ocean, especially in icy, rough seas like we get in the Arctic Ocean.
Environmental groups criticize the lease sale in the Chukchi Sea. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, December 2nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the top finishers in next year's Iditarod will win bigger prize money.
We wanted to enhance the financial reward of doing exceedingly well in this event.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, who believes that success isn't simply having an idea, it is knowing the right lender to help bring it to life. More at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
A federal agency has proposed about 350,000 square miles of ocean off Alaska's north and west coasts as critical habitat for the seal that's the primary prey of polar bears. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration announced today that it's proposing much of the Bering, Chukchi, and Beaufort Seas within U.S. jurisdiction as critical habitat for ringed seals. Shay Wolf is the climate science director of the Center for Biological Diversity. She says the habitat proposal is the largest in history.
We know that species that have critical habitat are twice as likely to be recovering as those without it. So we know that critical habitat works.
A critical habitat designation means federal agencies that authorize activities there must consult with NOAA Fisheries to determine the effects on seals. Wolf says the designation wouldn't ban oil and gas drilling, but it does require the permitting agencies to take extra precautions to ensure drilling won't harm the seal's habitat. But Senator Lisa Murkowski criticized the size of the proposed critical habitat area. In a news release, she says she is concerned that designation would severely impact any economic development. The seals were declared threatened in December 2012 because of the loss of sea ice from climate warming. Ringed seals use sea ice for breeding and molting. The agency will take public comment on the proposed critical habitat designation for 90 days. The Bureau of Ocean Energy Management is holding hearings around the state on Lease Sale 193 in the Chukchi Sea. In its latest environmental impact statement, BOEM says there's likely more oil there, but also more risk of a large oil spill. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
The Bureau says the leases off northwest Alaska are in one of the most petroleum-rich offshore areas of the country. The agency boosted its estimate of oil production to more than 4 billion barrels, but its report also says there's a 75% chance of a large oil spill, 1,000 barrels or more, if the Chukchi leases are developed. Tim Woody, Alaska Communications Manager for the Wilderness Society, points out that 1,000 barrels is 42,000 gallons.
The industry has no technology at this time to clean up meaningful amounts of oil spilled in any ocean, especially in icy, rough seas like we get in the Arctic Ocean.
Woody was one of dozens of people who turned out for a hearing on the lease sale in Anchorage Monday night. BOEM has held similar meetings in Wainwright and Point Hope on the Chukchi coast. Although the government is now seeking public comment on the Chukchi lease sale, the sale already took place, and Shell has already tried to drill an exploratory well on its Burger prospect there. The leases, though, are on hold due to an environmental lawsuit that forced the agency to rewrite its impact statement and reopen the public process. Proponents of offshore Arctic development told the Bureau the process has gone on long enough and the area has been thoroughly studied. Written comments focus on the jobs and economic benefits of production. Opponents, though, home in on the 75% likelihood of a large oil spill. The agency derived that figure from historical data and statistical estimates. Mike Ruthier, Program Analysis Officer for the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, says that risk is for the entire lifetime of the project.
So basically, contemplating a very high level of oil and gas activities over the course of nearly a century, the estimate would be that you know, there's a pretty decent chance that one or more of these large spills would occur.
Routhier also points out that large in this context isn't all that large. BOEM's assumption is one spill of about 5,000 barrels and another of about 2,000.
So those are certainly nothing to dismiss, but they're not the devastating, catastrophic types of oil spills that some people may imply.
BOEM is planning additional hearings on Lease Sale 193 in Barrow tomorrow and in Fairbanks on Thursday. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Financial uncertainty at the Anchorage School District is leading to morale problems and an inability to attract qualified teachers. The school board is looking for solutions. KSKA's Ann Hillman has more.
Marty Decker has taught English at Chugiak High School for 20 years, but now he's thinking of retiring early. His class sizes have grown, he has less support, and many of his fellow teachers have been transferred to other areas.
I love the kids, but the added duties and the stresses and the broken hearts of people around me being transferred away, etc., is pretty tough to take on.
Decker says it's no surprise to him that the district is having trouble recruiting new teachers because of low pay and no designated retirement. He says programmatic cuts are hurting students, too.
The kinds of experiences that make a kid want to go to school, their elective subjects, etc., have been basically gouged out of the scenario. And so I think that we're, in addition to the large class numbers that are sort of intimidating for students, there is less there for them to come to school for.
Decker spoke before the Anchorage School Board on Monday evening. Other parents and teachers talked about the lack of substitute teachers. When a sub can't be found, principals teach or classrooms are split up. The district is also having trouble hiring support staff, like IT technicians. ASD already has an extra $8 million in the fund balance because of the high vacancy rate and the lower salaries for the less experienced teachers they hired. If the trend continues, they'll have $21 million by the end of the fiscal year. But school board member Cameron Perez-Verdia doesn't see it as a budget surplus.
What we do have is a $22 million deficit this next year and a $70 million plus deficit in the next 3 years. We have a serious financial problem, and we also have serious internal challenges that we're dealing with because of the cutting that we've been doing for the last 3 years.
Perez-Verdia and other board members say they want to focus on improving student experiences and overall morale for the second semester of this year. So the district is considering solutions, such as increasing pay for substitute teachers. The rate hasn't been raised in 7 years. They're also looking at hiring a recruiter to help find qualified teachers, especially teachers for special education. That department has a 6% vacancy rate. Parents also made suggestions like giving retired teachers incentives to substitute teach, stop moving staff to different schools because that will improve continuity, and create schools where teachers feel safer expressing themselves. The board will make final decisions on how to spend the unassigned fund balance on December 15th. They could decide to put some of the money toward next year's projected fund deficit. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an unusual public market in Juneau.
We are officially roadkill recyclers, and the highways and byways of Alaska provide us with an abundance of inventory.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. And by Alaska Premier Dental Group, providing full-service dental care for the entire family with 3 offices, 2 in Anchorage and 1 in Wasilla. Service information at smilealaska.com.
Iditarod 2015 will have the highest winner's payout in the race's history. Stan Hooley, Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race CEO, says the first Tunome will receive $70,000. That's nearly $20,000 more than the winner earned last year.
The $50,000 increase this year will be spread over the first 5 finishing positions rather than throughout the entire field. So that's different for us this year. We wanted to enhance the financial reward of doing exceedingly well in this event.
Second through fifth place finishers will see substantial increases in prize money as well, from between $4,000 and $11,000 more, depending on the place finish. Hooley said the increase in prize money among the top five places is expected to spur an increase in competition by top mushers. To date, 79 dog drivers have signed up for the race. Hooley and Iditarod race director Mark Nordman also announced substantial changes in at least one portion of the trail to Nome. In 2010, a forest fire burned through a 20-mile stretch of the trail from Farewell to Roan. Over time, the trail in that area has become increasingly more difficult for mushers and their sleds due to fallen trees and to several winters with low snow. Iditarod race director Mark Nordman says the work will benefit all trail users.
And the main reason for it is just for the safety of for the dogs and the mushers. This is not just an Iditarod thing. This is something that local travelers from Nikolai and McGrath, Iron Dog, other events can go ahead and benefit on our work here. You know, we still need snow, you know, but this is going to allow us to get, you know, we're not going to need the foot and a half, 2 feet.
Nordman says the trail work has not added or taken away from the length of the Iditarod. The work was done with the help and contributions of local businesses. For decades, caribou have posed a threat to reindeer herders on the Seward Peninsula, their numbers swelling even as reindeer populations shrink. KNOM's Francesca Fenzi has the story.
An unidentified herd of animals has settled near Serpentine Hot Springs, in close proximity to several reindeer herding operations. And the animals' presence has both wildlife managers and reindeer herders asking, are they reindeer or caribou?
Nobody knows if it's a caribou herd reestablishing itself on the Seward Peninsula or if it's a group of reindeer that have run off and have gone feral.
That's Greg Finstad with the University of Alaska Fairbanks Reindeer Research Program. He says in order to solve the mystery, UAF's Reindeer Research Program is teaming up with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game to genetically test the animals. The two agencies are soliciting small tissue samples from hunters who harvested game, caribou or reindeer, near the Serpentine Hot Spring this summer. Those samples will then be compared with relatively pure reindeer samples from St. Lawrence Island and caribou samples from the interior, determining whether the Serpentine herd is more closely related to caribou or to reindeer. Jim Dow is an ADF&G biologist working on the project. He says while the distinction between the two animals may seem slight, it makes a big difference to reindeer herders in the region.
The reindeer industry has lost a tremendous number of reindeer, especially since the mid-90s to the Western Arctic herd. And those losses have occurred primarily when caribou that winter down there leave in the spring. You know, they can just overwhelm a reindeer range, and when they leave in the spring, they take reindeer with them.
If the animals are caribou, Dow says, they'll likely be viewed as a new threat, especially since they appeared at an unusual time of the year, summer, rather than the typical winter migration period. On the other hand, if the animals turn out to be reindeer, the reaction would likely be more optimistic. Again, Finstad.
If they are feral reindeer, then a reindeer herd can go out and recover them.
Finstad says a definitive ID would also make it clear which agency is responsible for the animals and who would have to foot the bill when it comes to monitoring them. For instance, caribou are public resources within the purview of ADF&G, while reindeer are under the stewardship of private herders. Finstad says monitoring becomes particularly important in the case of caribou. There's very little reindeer herders can do to protect their herds from a group of several thousand caribou, but early warnings do help.
If you have a group of reindeer, and if you know where the caribou are and where your reindeer are, you do have a chance you can maybe move them out of the way.
Still, Dow with ADF&G says tracking costs time and money. Warning systems rely on expensive radio collars, plus transportation and hours spent placing those collars on the animals. The total Western Arctic caribou herd is nearly 100,000 strong, and Dow says it's hard to justify placing several collars in a relatively small area like Serpentine when he has such a large group to worry about.
And there's another whole aspect to this, too. I mean, there's a whole lot of people on the Seward Peninsula that are not reindeer herders, and there are people in Nome and all the communities. They are absolutely delighted to have access to caribou. They want to go caribou hunting and get meat.
But when it comes to the Serpentine herd, identification is still the first step. Dow says ADF&G is still collecting samples from game harvested between May and August of this year in the Serpentine-Shishmaref area. Hunters interested in donating samples can bring or mail them to the ADF&G office in Nome. In Nome, I'm Francesca Fenzi.
The ferry Tustamina is getting old. The state is looking into options for repairing or replacing the aging vessel, which serves parts of south-central and southwestern Alaska, Kodiak Island, and the Aleutian Chain. Today, the Department of Transportation released the design study report for replacement with an estimated construction cost of $237 million. KBBI's Shady Grove Oliver has more.
The trusty Tusty serves one of the most demanding routes in the state, with rough seas and bad weather the norm.
The elements that the Tustamina sails in, it's made the age of the vessel, you could say, older than it actually is.
Jeremy Woodrow is a communications officer for the Alaska Marine Highway System. The Tusty entered service in 1964. That means it turned a hearty 50 years old this year. Woodrow says studies have shown it will be more cost-effective in the long run to replace it soon.
Think of it just as your car. It gets to the point where your car, finally, you only can replace the engine so many times, you only can replace the tire so many times before you just got to replace the vehicle.
The Tustamina and its proposed replacement are quite similar in design and aesthetics, but there are a few functional differences. Currently, all of the ports it serves have fixed docks, which is different from the floating docks of Southeast. That's why the Tusty uses an elevator system to load vehicles. It will still use that system most of the time, but it will have a modification.
That it will have an aft car deck door for vehicle loading and unloading operations at ports of call where they have what's called a floating dock. And so what this does is that the Tustamina replacement vessel will be more versatile. It can call in other ports. And if any of the ports are, or the docks are modified throughout the chain or in Kodiak Island or Homer, this vessel will be able to accommodate those docks in the future.
That thinking ahead is a common theme in the replacement design. It will be slightly larger at 330 feet long instead of 296 feet. It will also be able to accommodate 52 vehicles rather than 42. The number of passengers it can carry has jumped from 174 to 250.
And that will allow for growth. There is projection that there will be an increased amount of ridership over the course of the vessel's life in the area that it serves. And so being able to build a larger vessel while we can, we'll be able to accommodate that.
But it's also learning from experience. The newer Kennecott is the only other ferry capable of running the southwestern route. But it's run into some problems. Its size of 382 feet makes it a bit too big to dock in some of the smaller ports. So, like Goldilocks and the Three Bears, the specs for the replacement fall right in between the Kennecotts and the Tustaminas. It's not too big to fit, and not too small to be quickly outgrown. As for the other changes, the new vessel will also have a cafeteria and a faster cruising speed. It will add economy roomettes, more berths, and more ADA-compliant accommodations. It plans to employ the same number of crew, 38, in the summer, and one fewer in the winter. Woodrow says overall, it's a step in the right direction.
It'll be better for passengers. It'll be more cost efficient for the state to replace it in the future. And it'll be more cost efficient operational-wise as well.
The public comment period is open on the new design through January 9th, with plans to finalize the design by next winter. In Homer, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. You've heard of Black Friday, Small Business Saturday, and Cyber Monday. Well, now you're hearing about Giving Tuesday, a day to kick off the season of giving back on Tuesday, December the 2nd. Celebrate the season of giving with Alaska Public Media and the Alaska Community Foundation on Tuesday, December the 2nd, by giving a gift to the cause you care about most. When you live and give in Alaska, you make a real difference in your home community.
The Glory Hole, Juneau's emergency homeless shelter and soup kitchen, is temporarily out of commission following a burst water pipe and flood at the downtown facility on Sunday evening. Executive Director Maria Lovashuk, it says 21 patrons and an overnight staff member were at the shelter when the pipe burst.
I was not there, but from what I heard, you know, the floodgates opened and everybody got really cold and wet.
Lovashuk says City and Borough of Juneau emergency management officials set up a temporary shelter at the downtown transportation center. Patrons and staff were later relocated to the city's Zach Gordon Youth Center. She says Juneau International Hostel will provide rooms to Glory Hole clients while a contractor assesses the damage to the shelter. Downtown Juneau's Cathedral of the Nativity of the Blessed Virgin Mary has temporarily offered its parish hall for meal services.
Everybody was amazingly helpful. The city, the Red Cross, the local churches, the Glory Hole Board, just lots of really, really helpful entities.
Lovashuk says the facility will likely be closed at least a month for repairs. A compliance order from the State Department of Environmental Conservation spells out what Ketchikan is required to do over the next couple of years to address ongoing concerns over the city's drinking water. KRBD's Layla Carey has more.
The compliance order has been under development since this summer, and City of Ketchikan officials have participated in its drafting. It's a legally binding document, and violating it could lead to fines or civil or criminal court actions. Ketchikan Public Utilities Water Division Manager John Kleiniger says it's a way for the Environmental Protection Agency, along with state regulatory agencies, to make sure public water suppliers follow regulations.
They want to get the serious offenders, which unfortunately includes us, on the path of meeting the requirements of the surface water treatment rules. And the best way to do it is a legal document that both parties have to agree to.
The compliance order calls for Ketchikan to finish research into options for dealing with the source of the city's water and submit engineering design plans for any needed upgrades by the end of 2015. The city also must continue plans to upgrade its new water treatment plant and start testing for the waterborne parasite Cryptosporidium, something it's not tested for previously. Ketchikan's water supply has been problematic in recent years for a couple of reasons. First, Ketchikan Lakes, which is the source of the city's drinking water, has higher than allowed levels of coliform bacteria. The water is disinfected before it's distributed, but the Federal Environmental Protection Agency still regulates coliform levels in the source water. Kleiniger says it might be possible to resolve that issue through the city's ultraviolet radiation treatment system. The city's new treatment plant combines chemical and UV disinfection. Kleiniger cited a similar system in the Seattle area.
This is the Cedar River treatment plant, where, like us, they do have higher than acceptable levels of coliform, but they were also able to demonstrate to their regulatory agencies that by providing more ultraviolet disinfection than is technically required, that they were able to achieve a waiver.
Ketchikan also will investigate taking water from different locations in the lake. The second problem is that the city's water supply has a lot of organic material floating in it. And when that material comes in contact with chlorine disinfection, it forms byproducts that also are regulated by the EPA. The city's water has too many of those byproducts, despite the new treatment system that was built specifically to address that problem. That new system uses UV and chloramine, a blend of chlorine and ammonia, rather than chlorine alone. It brought the levels down, but not quite enough.
By what we've done thus far with chloramination, we have cut the level in half, but we're still not below 60 parts per billion. We're close, but close only counts in horseshoes.
The city has a plan underway to tweak the new treatment plant and get those byproduct levels below the threshold. That tweak is included in the water treatment compliance document. The city of Ketchikan is on the EPA's enforcement target list, according to City Manager Amelon, but signing off on the compliance order should satisfy EPA officials, at least for the time being. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
Artists and vendors from all over Alaska and some from the lower 48 landed in Juneau last weekend for the public market. It's part Christmas craft fair and part gallery. KTOO's Kayla DeRoche has more.
On the public market floor, a customer is chatting with Mary Ann Wick about porcupine carcasses. Wick of Talkeetna turns the quills into jewelry.
We are officially roadkill recyclers, and the highways and byways of Alaska provide us with an abundance of inventory.
Wick and her husband work together.
My husband does all the dirty work. He plucks quills and he dyes them, and they're washed several times. And then I sort them based on their size and use them in the different jewelry designs.
Wick says she accepts adult porcupines in exchange for merchandise. Another craftsman who uses animals for art is a Siberian Yupik carver and hunter.
My name is John Wari from Sivunga, Alaska.
The figurines on his table are of seals and walrus, among other animals. They're made from various animal parts, including walrus ivory and whalebone. Carving can be a slow process, like winter seal hunting.
We have to be very patient. Some days we'll come home with nothing. We live to expect those situations.
And respect is necessary.
We rely on history. We have to rely on our spirituality. We have to know the mannerisms of the animal. The animal, the resource that gives itself up, it's a gift from the Creator.
Steve Brown is from Washington and also carves in the Alaska Native tradition. Although not Native himself, Brown has formed close ties with the community over the years.
I've had the privilege of being adopted by the Kiksuti clan in Wrangell and given the name of a significant carver from that village from long ago.
He says the clan commissioned him along with some Tlingit craftsmen in 1984 and 1985.
We duplicated the Chief Sheikh's house posts, which date from the late 1700s.
He says the company of artists is part of the learning process.
I've had the privilege of working with a number of well-known Native carvers over the years. And, you know, even if you're just sitting around mutually working on things, you pick up ideas and techniques.
Brown also does Native design. With a twist, he carves the backs of pocket watches, and he credits the internet for being able to do that.
I'd looked for years in junk shops and stuff to find an engravable silver pocket watch, and despite spending many hours in junk shops, I never ran into one until the advent of eBay.
Mary Ann Wick uses the internet for her porcupine crafts, too. Her store, Stuck on You Quillworks, is on Facebook. In Juneau, I'm Kayla DeRoche.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ann Hillman and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Francesca Fenzi in Nome, Shady Grove Oliver in Homer, Casey Kelly and Kayla DeRoche in Juneau, and Layla Carey in Ketchikan. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
And by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Alaska Laborers Local 71 and the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities ask you to slow down in construction zones while they work to keep roads safe. Alaska Laborers Local 71, working hard for Alaska. This message is sponsored by Alaska Laborers Local 71.
Want to know more about how you and your family may get help buying health care coverage or avoid a tax penalty? Go to getcoveredak.org or call 211. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, a nonprofit health organization.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.